What is the thread that links us to the Great World War whose centenary we mark this year? Can those of us born decades after it ended ever bridge the gulf of experience that separates us from those who lived through it? I'm Alan Little, a BBC special correspondent, and in this collection of spoken essays called I Don't Remember the War, we've asked talented young writers around the world, all under the age of 35, to reach back across the generations and into the lives of grandparents or great-grandparents to try to make sense today of the values that drove them, the extremes they witnessed or survived, and the sacrifices they made. We'll be hearing from the Nigerian writer Chibundu Onuzo, Ned Bowman from Britain, Prajwal Parajulai from India, Keridwen Dovey, originally from South Africa, Rob Doyle from Ireland, and from Graz in southern Austria is our first essay, written and presented by Clemens Setz.
The father of my maternal grandfather died at a very advanced age when I was 7 or 8. He was a distinguished and well-mannered man, but also a rather peculiar and idiosyncratic one. I was very fond of him, and above all I especially loved his voice. He possessed, to my youthful eyes, what seemed to be a wondrous capacity. He could rotate his dentures all the way around in his large mouth, which always reminded me of the automatic changing of records in a jukebox. If he had changed a coin in his palm into a butterfly, I wouldn't have been any more impressed. I knew that he was a soldier in 2 wars, in the First World War in the Austrian army, in the Second World War as a glider pilot in the German Luftwaffe. Being a soldier in the Second World War was hidden, less discussed or present in everyday life. It wasn't a welcome topic of conversation in Carinthia during the 1980s. That's in the south of Austria, where in the rural areas Nazism survived in strange transformations and incarnations until far into the post-war period. Until a few years ago, it was the only Austrian federal state that was solidly in the hands of the FPÖ, the Freedom Party, a right-wing populist party whose members often had clear links to the active neo-Nazi movement. Luckily, my great-grandfather's advanced age meant that for him there was nothing in the world that could possibly be inappropriate. Whether it was due to myself asking or someone else, or just because it came to him, he used to talk about marching as a young man, sometimes for hours on end. There was a fascinating story about a fellow soldier's helmet being found in a most surprising place, the details of which I have unfortunately forgotten. There were stories about wounds, about sleeping under the open sky, about the cold in the mountains. It's certainly possible that in the memory of the old man both world wars blurred into one, but the official line was that he was speaking of the first. And whenever he did so, my great-grandfather, whom everyone called Uri, although his real name was Otto, spoke in a very unusual language. His mother tongue was called Windisch, which was then still a common term, but today is considered a derogatory term for a mixed dialect, a border Slovenian enriched with German words, word orders and melodies, a language that even today I can understand sometimes as if in a dream, a colorful and sunny language. As a child I could understand this language spoken by my great-grandfather, but never spoke it myself. Today I've forgotten it almost entirely. Normally, at the home of my grandparents, where my great-grandfather lived in a small, unadorned neighboring building, the normal Carinthian dialect was spoken, that is, German. But whenever the conversation turned to Prva Svetovna Vojna, meaning the First World War, my great-grandfather fell back to this way of speaking. As a child, I thus thought that anyone who speaks of the wars automatically had to use an artificial, archaic, ceremonial, strange-sounding language. I associated this resonant Windisch, in which, for example, the heat-plagued boredom of a field hospital was described, with the formulaic, sophisticated idioms that I only knew from films about knights in shining armor. In reality, it was just the language of his childhood that the old man was using. It was the language with the most profound claim on him, and even if his everyday life had to be mastered in German, he probably still thought and dreamed in that language as well. And when the long stream of narrative, which usually didn't really cohere, came to an end, he continued in this register for a while, no longer calling our cat by the German word Katze, but using the Windish term mača, in contrast to the normal Slovenian mačka. I thought it was reserved for stories from the past, an artificial language kept only for stories about the war that, like the expressions of officials and diplomats, created a distance due to its being difficult to understand, and which, as a result of its archaic effect, marked an event that entered the collective memory as one that is clearly closed off, that does not continue to the present. This childish mistake is actually the only thing that I personally associate with the First World War. Or rather, there's one more thing. In the small building where my great-grandfather lived, there was a room that I especially loved. Bizarrely, on a bed there, that was never used as such and was left uncovered, old military equipment was kept, primarily weapons and helmets, even boots that had fallen apart. I would put on the helmets and was amused by their weight. All these things were from the Second World War, except for one thing, a first aid kit that came from the First. It wasn't complete, but it was shown to me a few times and I was charmed by the huge glass syringes and the yellowed remains of bandages. There were several empty vessels and I envisioned their former content in the most vivid colors imaginable. I mentioned my mistake when it came to the private language of my great-grandfather. But it turned out that my idea with the abstract artificial language wasn't so wrong after all. For when I found out about the German poetry written during the First World War, it was the highly strange linguistic construction of a certain August Stramm. Stramm was a soldier during the First World War and died near Kobrin during a military campaign. During his period in the army, as he wrote in a letter, poetry came upon me like an illness. Later I also read the hypnotic poems of Georg Trakl, the Austrian Rimbaud, who committed suicide in 1914 as a soldier in Grodek by taking an overdose of cocaine after he was forced to witness the hanging of 13 Ruthenians from the trees. These poems weren't written in a true German, but in a strangely familiar private language. These poems seem like cities full of the war-marked and scarred, with sentences that lead, like unfinished stairwells, suddenly into nothingness. Piles of words are regrouped with puzzling haste, as if people were being herded from place to place. Sudden words of dialect bloom as small contained points of a former sense of security that the eyes can hold on to. A poem by August Stramm describes the grave of a fellow soldier. Stäbe flehen Kreuze Arme. Schrift sagt blasses unbekannt, Blumen frechen, Staube schüchtern, Flimmer tränet, Glas vergessen. Sticks plead crossed arms, Script hesitates, pale unknown, Flowers insulting, pollen bashful, Shimmer tears, glazes forgotten. Parts of speech, like noun, adjective, verb, no longer seem to work properly. All the same, we understand them, the brief, sad, lyrical utterances of a damaged brain. And as in a film projector that runs out of film, the series of images just stops. If Stramm had used normal everyday German, we would no longer be able to visit this grave of an unknown soldier. It would have long been overgrown by the things that came later.
That was Clemens Setz. The European powers, when they fought, drew their overseas imperial territories into the conflict with them. The parched high grasslands of South Africa are to this day dotted with the little neglected graves of an earlier war, from which the country was still recovering in 1914, and which gave South Africans a lasting war weariness. In the Anglo-Boer War, fought between Afrikaners and British, tens of thousands were killed, civilians as well as combatants. The horrors of civilian casualties and concentration camps prefigured much in the century that was to come. Keredwin Dovey, who now lives in Sydney, Australia, grew up in Pietermaritzburg, South Africa.
My South African family history is completely silent on the subject of World War I. No memories or anecdotes have been passed down, not a shred of a letter written from the front, not even one good story about hardship out in the colonies has survived. But when I started digging around, with my mom and dad enthusiastically helping by making calls to elderly relatives in South Africa, a different picture began to emerge. I discovered the real reason for this silence. Not a single one of my South African male ancestors signed up to fight for Britain in World War I. This was their choice. There was no conscription within the South African forces then. But to understand why they chose to stay at home instead of volunteering to fight, I had to go back a little further in time to a different war, the Anglo-Boer War fought between the Boers and the British over control of territories in what is now South Africa. I expected to hear stories of terrible suffering. The Boer War was, by official accounts, a savage conflict, and some of the methods used by the British would have constituted crimes against humanity by today's standards. But as my mother and her much older brother, my father and his brother-in-law, slowly collected crumbs from their memories for me to try to follow back into time, like a trail into very dark woods, I heard something different. My family's stories about that time are touching in their simplicity of regular people finding ways to connect, to coexist, even while they're on opposite sides. When the Boer War was declared in 1899, my great-grandparents on my mum's side, Isaac and Maria Horrock, were newlyweds, living in the small town of Winburg in the Orange Free State Republic. They were both from Afrikaner families who believed the two independent Boer republics, the Transvaal and the Orange Free State, had a right to exist free of British interference. Maria was 10 years younger than her husband, but it seems she was his intellectual equal. During their long courtship, they wrote love letters in Latin and English to each other. As a magistrate, Isaac would have been exempt from going on commando, the armed patrols that citizens of the Boer republics were expected to join to defend their farms against the British or the local black communities. After some initial victories for the Boers, the British regrouped and managed to occupy Bloemfontein and all the towns in its surrounds, including Winburg. When the British took the small town, the British officers asked Isaac to stay on in his role as magistrate. He did it on the condition that the officers wouldn't ask him to reveal any secrets that might compromise the Boer military operation. As soon as these officers discovered that Isaac and Maria could play an excellent game of bridge, they allowed them to break the imposed night curfew to sneak over to the officers' lodge for regular rounds. It's all quite civilized, really, and certainly not what I would imagine of the experience of having my own hometown occupied by hostile forces. One evening, a pack of drunk British soldiers tried to take a shortcut to their barracks through my great-grandparents' garden, and it happened to be on a night when the British officers had come over for a game of bridge. The officers were horrified at this bad behaviour from their men and rounded the soldiers up, pinning one over a large pumpkin, chasing another onto the roof of the house, ordering them all taken off in wheelbarrows, and afterwards punishing them so harshly that my great-grandparents felt quite sorry for them. This tale has survived, passed on over the generations, but these are caricatures and no longer hold any real clues to what my ancestors were thinking and feeling. It's possible their experience was unremarkable, just another of the common stories of basic civility on both sides in the first phase of the Boer War, when it was closer to a 19th century military engagement, led by supposedly genteel British officers and proud but fair Boers, all of whom agreed on certain codes of conduct. For example, allowing the other side to remove their wounded and even letting their own medical support teams treat the enemy's wounded once a major engagement was over. For this reason, the Boer War has sometimes been called the Last Gentleman's War. But as the war dragged on and the Boer commandos began to use guerrilla tactics, such as blowing up train tracks and making stealthy raids, the British forces began to respond more brutally themselves. Boer women and children were forced into disease-ridden concentration camps, and a scorched-earth tactic began of burning Boer farms. All of a sudden, the war had entered the 20th century, and its particular methods of terror foreshadowed those of the Great War. Isaac and Maria's experience must have been more painful and difficult than the family anecdotes suggest. For one thing, Winburg was the site of one of the most deadly of the British concentration camps for Boer women and children. The winters there were very cold, and over 300 children died in this camp alone. During one of those winters, Maria and Isaac lost their own first baby to hydrocephalus, water on the brain. But nobody can now remember that child's name. I can't help but think of the magistrate in J.M. Coetzee's allegorical novel, Waiting for the Barbarians, a searing critique of colonial power relations. In the book, this magistrate's moral certainties are undermined when the empire he serves declares a state of emergency due to rumours of an invasion by the barbarians. Gradually, the magistrate's ignorance and idealism are replaced by the horror of experience. In the final scene, the magistrate, now a broken man, watches the first snow of winter fall on his small frontier town, awaiting the next barbarian attack, which may or may not ever come.
That was Ceridwen Dovey. To a knowing eye, more benign signs of the First World War are evident in the Sikkim state, amidst the tea plantations of the Himalayas in northeast India, home to Prajwal Parajulai.
For too long, Takda, a charming town not far from Darjeeling in the Indian Himalayas, has lived in its glamorous neighbour's shadow. Built by the British during the Raj so World War I soldiers could recuperate amidst mountains, coniferous vegetation and tea plantations, the settlement delights with colonial buildings, picturesque sunrises and views of Mount Kanchenjunga. After India attained independence in 1947, the cantonment town was quickly forgotten, while nearby hill stations such as Darjeeling and Kurseong continued to thrive as tourist destinations. My grandfather was born in 1918 in Kalimpong, 2 hours by road from Takda. World War I had just ended. Baba, my grandfather, always said that he regretted not having been born during the war. For a war can provide a man who fancied himself as a storyteller with a lifetime of fodder. Never mind that Baba wouldn't have remembered much of the war had he been born a year before it ended. Or the year before that, or even at the start of the war. His father, despite having lived through all of the war, had little to remember it by. Kalimpong, far away in the Himalayas, was hardly affected by World War I beyond sacrificing a few of her sons as recruits in the Gurkha regiments. Baba hated not being in the middle of action. That boring life of spewing mantras and marrying people off wasn't for me, Baba would declare as he spat his tobacco out the window. Now, fighting World War I like those useless soldiers at Takda, that's the life I was meant to live. To him, the war meant tanks, bombing, and foreign places. Boom, hit thunder. That's how I would bomb the Germans. He, of course, conveniently forgot that he couldn't even fight future wars because he was a Brahmin. And a Brahmin, by virtue of his caste, was forbidden from killing. My grandfather very often had crazy ideas. Perhaps that's why when he declared that he wanted to start a hotel in his early 80s, we weren't shocked. Takda, with its history as a sanatorium for World War I soldiers, was a natural fit for Baba. He said he would call it World War I tourism. No, it wasn't tongue-in-cheek. The children, my cousins and I, were excited. The fathers, my father and uncle, were skeptical. We whizzed past Kalimpong's Mela Ground, the multi-purpose sports stadium. This was built with the purpose of recruiting Gurkhas to fight World War I, Baba said. Clearly, everything would be given a World War I twist today. How would you know? I asked. You don't believe me? He said. And then he sang. Come, brothers and sisters, let's go bomb Germany. It was the recruitment song, he said, and sang it again. But you weren't even born then, my sister said. I know these things, came Baba's reply. The children exchanged looks but remained quiet. The journey to Takda entailed a 16-kilometre decline from Kalimpong to Teesta and a corkscrewing incline after Teesta. Both declines and inclines were rife with serpentine roads and hairpin bends, and Baba's plans of selling World War I to tourists. Takda was beautiful. "It's like a foreign country," we exclaimed. Misty, cool, verdant, and best of all, virginal. It wasn't full of rubbish the way Kaohsiung was. Every second building was in a hotel like it was in Darjeeling. The place was devoid of traffic, honking, and tourists. "And that's the officer's mess," Baba said, pointing to yet another relic. "If restored, it would be beautiful. That could be another tourist attraction." "My father and uncle had reservations. Why would people come here when they can go to Darjeeling?" my father asked. "They can go to both Darjeeling and here," Grandpa replied. But his sons weren't convinced. A few months later, Baba had a stroke. When he was conscious, Baba sometimes babbled about the resort. "I've done everything I ever wanted to do but that," he'd say. "That would have been my legacy. It's been a good life otherwise." He died soon after. Following the cremation, I headed to the airport, taking the same path as I had many years ago with him, past the Mela ground and then downhill, until Teesta, where the road bifurcated. The driver wanted to stop for tea. I had time, so instead of going straight to the airport, I asked him to ascend to Takda. The town was still beautiful, but was gradually awakening to its potential. There were tourists, both domestic and foreign. The colonial mansions had charming homestay signs outside them. It seemed the locals had finally embraced their home's money-making ability. A few signs even pointed to orchid farms. A lout, who declared that he was a guide, sauntered up to me. 500 rupees for all the tourist points. The tea gardens, the officer's mess, the orchid greenhouses, and the best viewpoint to see Mount Kanchenjunga," he said. "I'm not staying," I replied. "And the houses where World War I soldiers recovered," he added. "Best World War I tourism. It will be unlike anything you've seen before."
That was Prajwal Parajulai. I'm Alan Little, and this is I Don't Remember the War here on the BBC World Service. We'll hear from more writers in a moment.
The BBC World Service.
A series of mishandled executions and a shortage of lethal injection drugs have called into question the future of the death penalty in America.
The system is falling apart. It cannot be trusted to do what it's being asked to do, which is decide who should live and who should die.
I'm Regina Vaidyanathan, and for the BBC World Service, I've come to the southern state of Tennessee, which recently passed a bill to bring back the electric chair.
I had friends that had been murdered, and I feel like that is an appropriate use of punishment in order to bring justice and give those families a sense of closure.
America is one of the few Western countries to still carry out executions. But do recent events mean we'll soon be at the end of death row?
At the end of death row. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
Capturing the raw human experience of conflict, the ideals and sentiments that propel the young to combat, is a challenge I've faced over the years as a BBC reporter. But how can a young writer convey the visceral reality of a distant, half-remembered war? I'm Alan Little, and after the news, we'll hear from young writers trying to bridge the gap to the First World War. Chibundu Onutsu's story comes from Nigeria, Rob Doyle from Ireland, while Ned Bowman's looks to Britain.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. A 12-hour pause in hostilities has come into effect in Gaza after an agreement between the Israeli government and Hamas. Israel has described it as a humanitarian window, but said it would continue operations to destroy tunnels used by Palestinian militants during this time. Gaza health officials say dozens of bodies have been recovered since the truce began. Foreign ministers from the US, several EU countries, Turkey and Qatar are about to meet in Paris to discuss ways of achieving a longer truce in Gaza. The European Union has expanded its blacklist of Russian individuals and organisations, which will be subject to asset freezes and travel bans in protest at Russia's role in the Ukraine crisis. The EU said the list now included the names of two top security and intelligence chiefs, Alexander Bortnikov and Mikhail Fradkov. 40 military police officers from the Netherlands have arrived in eastern Ukraine to help search for bodies from the Malaysian airliner, apparently shot down there 9 days ago. They're joining a team of Australian police hoping to travel from the city of Kharkiv to the crash site, which is in territory held by pro-Russia rebels. The Nigerian government says all points of entry into the country have been placed on red alert following confirmation that a Liberian man, who died in hospital in Lagos, was carrying the Ebola virus. It's the first confirmed case in Nigeria since the start of an outbreak which has killed more than 600 people in West Africa this year. The first team of Pakistani mountaineers to attempt to scale the country's highest peak, K2, is expected to reach the summit today. The expedition marks the 60th anniversary of the first ascent of the mountain by Italian climbers in 1954. A judge in the northern English city of Manchester is being investigated after he was accused of falling asleep during a child rape trial. The case was halted and must now start again. BBC News.
Who is fighting whom and why? What drives men and women, the young in particular, into mortal combat, ready to die, often for an abstract ideal? It is a question I have grappled with in my years as a BBC reporter, caught up in more recent wars, in Iraq, Rwanda, Congo, the Balkans, Sierra Leone. And what happens to that intense, highly immediate experience as time passes? How do subsequent generations rethink and reimagine those experiences? Can we reach back into lives lived before we were born and really know what it was like? In the second part of I Don't Remember the War on the BBC World Service, we hear from young writers from around the world, all 35 or under, who try and connect to the First World War through the story of a grandparent or great-grandparent. Chibundu Onutsu's bridge to the First World War in Nigeria came from a long-time family friend.
He is old and frail and blind. When he enters the room, he will not acknowledge us until he has manoeuvred himself into a sitting position. We watch him creep forward, his hands running across the wall, then stretching through the air until they touch the sofa. He bends slowly, careful of his body that has lasted him so long. Finally, he is seated and we may greet him. We kneel, my mother and I. At 95, if you live to see it, this is how you will be greeted, even when you are blind and cannot tell if people are kneeling or not. I've come to find out about the war. The Biafran War? No, the World War. He straightens and laughs like a boy, Peter Pan aged and forgotten in Lagos. They told us Hitler was going to come and make us all slaves. Black slaves for his blue-eyed Aryans. That's how they got us to go to Burma. No, not Hitler. The First World War. He loses interest. He was only a baby then, born the year of the armistice. He has no memories of that war. I press. He remembers vaguely someone else's memories handed down to him. A bush telephone running from Calabar to the front in German Cameroon, wooden stakes driven to the ground, wires strung above them, the bush crowding in on either side, threatening to swallow the messages relayed from the edge of the British Empire to the edge of the Kaiser's Empire. That is all. The room is silent. My mum on the other side of the long parlour is tapping on the screen of her iPad. She makes a leaving sign. There were the tall tales those rascals brought back. Which rascals? The veterans. What did they say? Nothing. Lies. Don't want to tell the BBC lies. He chuckles. He has written for the BBC before, when he was a student in London. He needed the money. Wrote them some nonsense, picture postcard tripe, life in Nigeria. There are still traces of England in his speech, his clipped pronunciation of absolutely not, when I plead with him for one tall tale, just one story. He is enjoying himself. Mariam, he calls to my mother, your daughter's Wahala is too much. Yes, she agrees. My trouble is a lot. He knew my mother when she was a child, when her knees were close to the ground and she cried to be carried all the time. There is something to be wondered at in the three of us in one room, 73 years between the oldest and the youngest. He makes a great show, but finally he capitulates. But just one story. In England, it begins once upon a time. In Kenya, Hadithi Hadithi. And in Nigeria, Alo. The audience replies, Alo. There was a man, Baba Onifade, village drunk and ne'er-do-well. He counted the days in beer bottles, passed the nights in wine bowls, was soaked in alcohol from morning to night, his insides a constant ferment of spirits. He was married to Mama Onifade, long-suffering and strong-armed, capable of lifting him from gutters and dragging him home to be doused in cold water. Throughout their village, Baba Onifade was known as the thoroughly useless devotee of Ogun. Ogun, god of war in the Yoruba pantheon, the hunter's god, and god of all iron instruments, hoes, hammers, anvils, axes, mallets, and machine guns. One day, the king's recruitment officers marched into town like a carnival, with drums and horns and cymbals, the soldiers oiled and shiny in their new kit. Baba Onifade was only half drunk that morning, and by sundown he had taken the king's silver shilling and the king's khaki uniform and the king's leather boots. But when he reached home and Mama Onifade began to cry at the sight of him, he realized something. He did not want the Kaiser's bullet in exchange. It was a rather stiff bargain now that he thought of it, as stiff as the leather of his new boots that would take many miles of marching to break in. The next morning, Baba Onifade went to consult the Ifa oracle. Ifa knows you are a soldier and you don't want to die. Ogun will ask for a sacrifice. The sacrifice was not so heavy, Baba Onifade said to his wife when he returned home. A bowl of grain mixed with water to be thrown out of the window every morning, along with a brief incantation. Tell your wife, the oracle had said. If she does this without fail, you will return home to her bed and her arms. Who said I want you in my bed? Mama Onifade said. Did you ask the oracle how I am going to get a bowl of grain every morning? I haven't fed the children. You want me to throw food away? So I should die? Mama Onifade, I should die? Husband and wife glared at each other. The next morning, Baba Onifade began the march to German Cameroon. It soon became apparent that he was not meant to be a soldier. He was often out of sync, his salute rising a fraction too late, his feet stamping attention in a rhythm of its own. At the front, his first instinct was to run from the bullets. Deserters will be shot, they were told on their first day. One afternoon, on a routine reconnaissance, Baba Onifade's platoon ran into the Kaiser's forces. They engaged the enemy, filling the bush with the steady drum of machine gun fire. They were outnumbered. Ammunition was running low. They would soon be overwhelmed. A sacrifice was needed. A soldier must stay behind, firing, while the rest escaped. No volunteer stepped forward. Well then, the British officer said, red-faced and fatigued. We'll cast lots. Lots. A method as old as Ogun, and the cup of grain Mama Onifade had thrown out that morning. It fell to Baba Onifade to remain. The rest crept away, leaving him manning three machine guns, then two, then one, then none, until there was silence in the bush. Baba Onifade looked for a token of Ogun. The iron of the guns. He placed the hot metal machine gun on his head and began to call on his deity. Ogun, he said. Ogun, Ogun. He saw the god running across a black sky, his white hunting dogs trailing behind him, in his hand a long iron sword crimson with blood. The god stopped mid-stride and looked down to earth. Who is calling me? Onifade blinked and saw the Kaiser's forces had surrounded him, all Africans except for a German officer, red-faced and fatigued. Where are the rest? Ogun, Ogun, take that gun from him. You three, tie his arms. Shoot him deeper in the forest and bury him. Meet us back at base. Ogun, Ogun. The Kaiser's commanding officer waited until Baba Onifade's arms were secured, and then the Kaiser's troops marched away. The three remaining soldiers led Baba Onifade deep into the forest. Ogun, Ogun, Ogun! He began to chant faster when they came to a halt. Benue Dake! You are Yoruba? Baba Onifade said in shock. Yes, and I am also a worshipper of Ogun. My wife is sacrificing daily for me to return home. But how come you are fighting for the Germans? Whichever side you're on, the matter is not our business. The man slit the bonds on his wrists. Disappear. Baba Onifade made his way back to base, and for his bravery, he was kept in the kitchens until the end of the war. When he returned home, there were green corn stalks growing outside their window. Mama Onifade's bed, despite many propositions, was still empty. She had not missed a single day of sacrifice. And that was how Baba Onifade survived the war. So really, we have Mama Onifade to thank for this tall tale. What happened to him afterwards? The British treated the native ex-servicemen rather well. His mouth contracts. By rather well, I mean they made them labourers and prison wardens, that sort of thing. It wasn't educated Africans that went to fight for them. The educated ones saw through all that propaganda. Well, at least we had educated Africans. In German Cameroon, they held the natives back. No education past Standard 6, no doctors, no lawyers. It was just one big banana plantation. But surely, there weren't that many Nigerian graduates in 1914. Nigeria must have been one big palm oil plantation. Mariam, take this your daughter away. It's time for my nap.
That was Chibundu Anuzu. In many countries, the war only highlighted conflicting loyalties. Ireland was still, in 1914, part of the United Kingdom, governed from the imperial capital, London. Hundreds of thousands of Ireland's young men would enlist to fight for a king and country they would soon come to repudiate, for the war would bring the movement for Irish independence to a head and, in the end, propel it into a civil war that pitted Irishmen against Irishmen. Rob Doyle lives in County Wexford, Ireland.
England's difficulty is Ireland's opportunity. Such had been the slogan for generations of nationalists who sought to rid Ireland of the colonial power that had occupied it for 700 years, and which they believed had stripped the country of its identity, oppressing its people. The slogan assumed a new urgency during the years of the Great War, which partly coincided with the most convulsive decade in modern Irish history, that which ended in 1922, with the establishment of the Irish Free State and the beginning of the withdrawal of British power. Ireland's role in the Great War was far from simple. Even within families, my own for instance, there were enormous differences in how Irish people experienced the war, and even in which sides they took. Swept along by historical currents they may not have fully understood, Irishmen like my great-grandfather, Patrick O'Sullivan, left home to aid the British Empire in its war effort, whereas others, like Patrick's son-in-law, Michael Doyle, stayed in Ireland to sabotage British rule while the empire was diverted in the trenches of Europe. Of course, these events took place a century ago, and as I investigate these two men's divergent roles during the war, all I have to go on is family anecdote and a few faded photographs. Michael Doyle, my grandfather, was born in County Kerry in 1905 and died in 1981, the year before I was born. Michael's wife, Sheila, never lost her Kerry accent after the couple moved up to Dublin to raise their 8 children. Throughout my childhood, my brothers and I used to visit Sheila every weekend in her house in the suburb of Drimna, with its forbidding thicket of a back garden that receded infinitely, or so it seemed to me then. I remember the framed photographs that stood on the mantelpiece of my grandfather in his heyday. A lamentably incurious boy, I don't recall ever asking my grandmother a single question about her deceased husband, or about anything at all, really. Now, of course, it's too late, and I regret it, as I will doubtless one day regret not having asked my own parents more about their lives while there was still time. With the aid of my family's recollections, though, I have since learned a little more about the grandfather I never knew. Michael Doyle spent the war years in Dublin, working as a messenger boy for a company based on George Street, a couple of minutes' walk from Dublin Castle, which was then the seat of British power in Ireland. It was through his job as a messenger boy that Michael Doyle played his part in the seizing of Ireland's revolutionary opportunity from England's wartime difficulty. From the age of 12, Michael delivered groceries to the homes of well-heeled Dublin families and brought sandwiches to office workers for their lunch breaks. Messenger boys such as him were a common sight in those days, their bicycles whizzing and weaving amid trams, carts and traps. One of Michael's regular ports of call was Dublin Castle. At some point, he was approached by members of the Irish Volunteers, the militant organisation which would, in a few years' time, evolve into the Irish Republican Army. Empowered by the swelling of nationalist sentiment following the failed rising of Easter 1916, the Volunteers were preparing to wage a war for independence. Michael was asked if he was willing to help the nationalist cause by smuggling documents out of Dublin Castle. He agreed to do it. He would have been a skinny whippet of a boy, is how my father, Jimmy Doyle, describes the grandfather I never met. I'm something of a skinny whippet myself, I might add, as are all the males in my family. In photographs taken years after these events, Michael is a middle-aged man with receding hair, tall and thin. In one photo, he is arm in arm with my grandmother, Sheila, then a beautiful young Kerry woman, her coat draped over Michael's linking arm. Michael seems to have dressed exclusively in the formal apparel that was de rigueur back then, all neat grey jackets and baggy slacks. According to the stories passed down by his children, Michael was successful as a smuggler of documents out of Dublin Castle. He was a charming, chatty boy whose personality and demeanour misled the security guards who searched him as he entered and exited the castle. They wouldn't have taught him the type to be putting his life at risk at the service of paramilitary nationalists who are conspiring to overthrow the most powerful empire on earth. I don't know if the documents that my grandfather stole from Dublin Castle for the Republicans ever led to any concrete actions. Perhaps he simply grabbed whatever he could and, being a scarcely educated boy from the sticks, had scant means of discerning which documents were worth snatching and which were of no use at all to his clandestine supervisors. It is possible that all he ever stole was bureaucratic detritus, the kind of inconsequential paperwork that piles up in any ministry or governmental premises. Not all of Michael's contemporaries chose to exploit Britain's involvement in the Great War to further the Republican cause. 250,000 Irishmen enlisted in the British Armed Forces during World War I. More than 30,000 of them did not survive to see the armistice. My great-grandfather, the Kerry man Patrick O'Sullivan, served with the Royal Navy as a fitness instructor. After the war, there was a period of danger for Irish ex-servicemen, as the matter was debated within hardline sections of the Republican movement as to whether the servicemen had betrayed Ireland by aiding the British, and therefore merited punishment. It seems my great-grandfather had to keep a low profile for a period back in Kerry, fearing assassination at the hands of nationalist extremists. One family legend even has him hiding under the petticoats of an elderly woman who was visiting the house when the nationalists raided it, intending to kill him. I can't be sure whether my great-grandfather's life ever really was in such danger after the war. It would seem harsh to condemn a man to death for serving as a fitness instructor. But what about the stigma, if there was any? The shame and dishonour of having served with the British? Did he feel it? Was he, perhaps, even drawn to it? For all my explorations and questions, I still cannot feel I know much about either of these men, Patrick O'Sullivan or Michael Doyle, who had parts to play in the Great War, however oblique and minor. It does, however, afford me a certain gratification to know that I have this connection to the war, that outbreak of unparalleled barbarism which split its century in two. From the vantage point of the strange, no doubt ephemeral bubble of ease and stability in the Western Europe where I am living 100 years after the Great War, the thoughts of my grandfather spiriting documents past the guardians of the British Empire as they patted him down in the anterooms of Dublin Castle goads me to wonder how I would acquit myself were I ever in a similar predicament, were I ever to be tested. Frankly, I've never considered myself a particularly brave person. The risk of violence, torture, imprisonment or death, along with an aversion to heroic posturing and an incorrigible contrary streak, make it easier to imagine myself in the role, not of the resistor, but of the collaborator, whenever I project myself back into this or any other fraught historical scenario. Perhaps I'd have done as Patrick O'Sullivan did and joined the British Navy. Perhaps the craving for dishonour would have outshone the lure of glory. And yet, maybe we are better men than we suspect ourselves of being. Maybe there are certain circumstances, war for instance, which, against our will, push us to our limits, force us to discover that, in the crucible of history, rather than lay down and take it, we would rise up, take some kind of a stand, act in a manner we would be glad to know would be remembered 100 years later, on the anniversary of our vanished war.
That was Rob Doyle. The First World War opened a new frontier in human conflict, war in the air. Previous generations had dreamed of taking to the skies, but this generation could take the war there. Our last writer is from Britain. Ned Bowman lives between New York and London.
On the 3rd of August 1914, my grandfather, Eric Bentley Bowman, received a telegram, which my parents still have in a box, telling him he had been appointed a probationary flight sub-lieutenant. He was only 23, but he had already trained at two different flying schools, and by the standards of the day, was a moderately experienced pilot. When he arrived at the Royal Navy airfield at Eastchurch in Kent, the company commander there said to him, "Can you fly a Caudron biplane?" "No, sir," replied my grandfather. "Do you know the way to Hendon?" asked the company commander. "No, sir," replied my grandfather. "Very well," said the company commander. "At dawn tomorrow, you will fly a Caudron biplane to Hendon." So my grandfather did. When he arrived at the airfield in Hendon, the director of the Air Division of the Admiralty said to him, "You are now the Defence of London from air attack." "But I haven't got an observer or any armaments," said my grandfather. "What could I do if a Zeppelin does come over?" His commanding officer replied, "I leave that to you." 10 days passed before any other pilots arrived at the airfield to relieve my grandfather. Recalling the period in an article published many years later, he wrote, "Fortunately for London, and for me, no Zeppelin appeared over the city while I was defending it in this way." And in fact, the first Zeppelin raid on London didn't take place for another 5 months until January 1915. I never heard this story firsthand from my grandfather, because he died in 1989 when I was 4 years old. But in the past, I've told various garbled and half-remembered versions of this story. When I look at photographs of Bentley now, I can't see any real resemblance between us, except in two respects. One is his high forehead. The other is that in one picture, he's trying to make a terrier look as if it's riding a motorcycle, which is exactly the kind of thing I want to do when I see a small animal. Anyway, in his written recollections of his time at Hendon Airfield in 1914, my grandfather tells one other story which I want to repeat here. "Every evening for several hours," my grandfather writes, "an RNVR lieutenant used to watch the skies for the appearance of hostile aircraft from a tethered balloon a few hundred feet up. For some time, he had nothing to report. Then one night, he suddenly signalled down that a Zeppelin was approaching, rapidly flashing red, yellow and green lights. There were as yet no flares available to assist takeoffs or landings in the darkness. While we were considering what could be done, to our astonishment we heard a machine starting up and flying off into the night. Then I was told that the peacetime manager of the aerodrome, himself a pilot, Richard Gates, had persuaded a mechanic to wheel out an 80 horsepower Henri Farman and start up the engine for him. A short time later, it returned, circled the airfield, and crashed. We rushed to find poor Gates completely crushed by the engine, which was situated immediately behind the pilot in this type of machine. A few minutes later, the balloon observer signalled down that he thought that the flashing lights he had reported must have been given out by the variable star Vega. And that's that. Richard Gates may have been the very first aviation casualty of the First World War, while my grandfather lived another 75 years. I know I'm not exactly the first writer ever to remark upon the horrifying arbitrariness of war, but I think these two stories, with their very different endings, do tell us something about the uses we make of the family lore that's passed down to us. Imagine if Gates, instead of being crushed by the engine, had merely sprained his ankle or got a face full of mud. Think again of that last sentence. A few minutes later, the balloon observer signalled down that he thought that the flashing lights he had reported must have been given out by the variable star Vega. If he'd survived, that would have made a first-rate punchline to a first-rate anecdote. But he didn't. So instead of a story about a funny mistake, it's a story about utter randomness and futility. And imagine if the Germans had sent over their first Zeppelins 5 months earlier. The planes of that era were as spindly as penny farthings, and, as my grandfather noted, he was absolutely alone, with no observer and no armaments. He would no doubt have faced the threat bravely, and he might easily have perished in the process. Think again of his exchange with the director of the air division. What could I do if a Zeppelin does come over? I leave that to you, sub-lieutenant. If my grandfather had indeed died, that exchange would have been a grotesque indictment of the callousness and short-sightedness of the British officer class. Instead, it's a charming example of dry wit and stiff upper lip. When we are in the mood to think about war as a stage for courage and ingenuity and stoicism and good humour, when we are in the mood, in other words, to believe that everything will be all right in the end as long as we pull together, we tell stories like the one about my grandfather and the Zeppelins that never arrived. When we are in the mood to think about war as a Ragnarok of horror and cruelty and unfairness and waste, when we are in the mood, in other words, to believe that all civilization stands on the edge of a precipice, we tell stories like the one about Richard Gates and the twinkle of Vega. We comfort ourselves with the first kind, or scare ourselves with the second, as required. But of course, the apparent coherence of a war story, the inevitability, the moral shading, are all just packaging that we impose in retrospect. As I'm sure my grandfather understood all too well, there are no stories, only events, one after another, after another, after another, and some of them kill you, and some of them let you live.
That was Ned Bowman. The other writers you've heard in I Don't Remember the War are Clemens Setz, Ceridwen Dovey, Rob Doyle, Chibundo Onutsu, and Prajwal Parajulai. Where possible, each of the writers has sent a photograph of their elderly relative, which you can see on the BBC World Service website. I'm Alan Little, and through these vivid stories and imagined moments, grandchildren and great-grandchildren have tried to find the thread that links them to earlier lives, lives lived in or close to the heat of what was, 100 years ago, the most destructive war in human history, and an experience that endures in the imagination and the collective memory of those of us who came after. I Don't Remember the War is a cast-iron radio production for the BBC World Service.